During this time period, 1964, did the band wear matching outfits on stage or not?
Oh, we had some dandy little outfits. I don't remember where we bought that. We had a set of, there's a name for the shiny material that they make the suits out of.
Polyester?
Well, it was polyester something. Yeah, they almost glowed. And they had one set, you could wear it with no collar. Then it had a cloth collar that matched the, and they were suits, you know, the pants and the jackets matched. And then it also had a black velvet collar, so we could wear the velvet collar or the cloth collar or no collar at all.
Nate's Menswear.
Yeah, Nate's was a big shot.
When we walked in there, they were all smiles because they not only sold one suit, they sold four suits. and we had a reputation of trying to wear matching and dress up for the occasion. We even bought a whole bunch of costumes from this costume company downtown St. Paul, right by the Ordway, that was selling stuff cheap. And we had top coats, and we had barber striped shirts and surfing shirts and all kinds of stuff.
The tuxedos, though, from the costume shop were really old when we bought them, and they were that heavy wool tails, and the pants were the formal pants that were wool, and we brought them all in and had them tapered, of course, so you had it, the pants would be tight. Hugh still has the jacket from that tuxedo.
So I assume it got a little hot on stage?
Oh, it was awful. And they had the stand-up, those starch collars that were separate from the shirts. Then you'd have there were brass buttons that held them on. And then you had an ascot that you wore. And we could wear that in the wintertime, but you just couldn't go near it in the summertime. You'd just die on stage with those. But they were pretty fancy looking outfits.
Now, does the band have a sound man or a light show at this time?
Well, in terms of the light show, those two guitar coffin cases, they would be propped open, and a light bar would fit in those. And we always had some kind of a changeable, movable light display. That was, since I stood between the two guitar players, that was my job, was to hit the button at the right time for either some kind of a light shift or lights out or some kind of a rotating. And there was a couple of, we went through a couple of different schemes of lights, and a lot of times they just weren't rugged enough to withstand my foot or the road or whatever, but we always had them, and they always seemed to work out well. And it was just the idea of increasing the presence of, or making it special, or show up, or flashy, or showy, whatever that we were aiming for.
A couple guys in Stillwater made light systems for us. Dale Dorr and Rod Hobson, I think his name was. And eventually we had them, they provided them. I mean, we paid them for it. But the lights, there were probably four spotlights on each side mounted on a stand. And then the thing that Hugh had would make them flash alternately. It was pretty impressive for 1964 or 65, the different colored lights.
Now, did you have a sound man or not?
No.
In terms of the PA, it was a ongoing battle. We tried a number of things because, again, we were trying to emphasize the vocals, and we wanted a very loud but a very clear PA. And so we tried horns, we tried voice of the theater, you know, everything from low-tech to high-tech. The low-tech stuff was very durable enough, the high-tech stuff very, very clear, but not very reliable. Later on, I suppose that was 66 or 7 maybe, I went and saw the Turtles, and what they had is two large guitar amplifiers. I think they were Sun or whatever, as their PA, and it sounded superb. So we went over to Jim Lopez, B-Sharp, and bought two dual Showmans, tops and bottoms, amp and enclosures, and the XL cabinetry, which was bigger than the standard dual Showman like I had for a bass amp, and set those up, had a Shure Vocalmaster we plugged the three microphones into, no EQ, no any effects whatsoever, just raw. We ran with that, no monitors, no sound man, and it was incredibly clear and incredibly simple.
We could easily fill an armory, you know, almost put out matches in the back of the armory with those Showman. And it was always clear, and it was never distorted. It was just a terribly easy system. And now that we've started playing again, we're back to fighting that battle again with the monitors. And with the, do you use horns? Do you use this? Do you do that? And everybody's got their own idea, but those dual Showmans were just wonderful for us.
Now, I heard you had your own road manager.
Another classmate. Everybody that we've talked about so far have been high school classmates. And Jim just happened to be a kid that I grew up with. We grew up almost next door to each other. He just took a liking to the band, came along with us and helped us set up. Of course, this is back in the day when the average guitar amplifier probably weighed 125 pounds, at least, PAs and all that stuff, and drums. And he came along a lot and helped set up and take down, and was a big fan.
And Jim's last name was?
Jesse, Jim Jesse Jr.
So you guys are playing in a rock band at the height of the Beatlemania period. You're still in high school. What impact did this have on you at school in relation to friends?
We were... I think a lot of our class and some of the underclassmen too thought it was pretty cool that there was a band from Stillwater. But most of my friends the people that I still have as friends from Stillwater, just thought that we had kind of a really cool job, that they might work at the golf club or they might work at the drugstore downtown, and we just worked in Taylor's Falls on one Friday night and in Rice Lake on a Saturday night. And They certainly weren't starstruck, and I don't think we ever were either. It was just a job. It was good money, and it was fun. And we met some girls. There was always some girls. And a beer or two every once in a while.
So we wrap up 64, move into 65. Any changes occur in 65 or not?
No.
The biggest change was Tommy and I went to Mankato State. That made things a little strange because Roy was going to the U of M and Hugh was at Hamlin. And Tommy and I went to Mankato State.
Still booked by David Anthony?
Yes. Yep. But I had a 56 Ford. So if we were playing Southern Minnesota, Tom and I would just leave from Mankato State and meet Hugh and Pinky at the jobs because Hugh had the hearse, and we'd drive the hearse over, and we'd go over in the 56 Ford and meet up and set up and play, and then go back down to Mankato State on Sunday night.
Hugh, what's the story on the hearse?
Cheap transportation, big transportation. I think the first one was about a 1950 Cadillac, and we bought that from a guy in Stillwater, I think. Wasn't that Gus Glassroot?
Do you remember what you paid for it?
Oh, it couldn't have been much. Maybe a couple hundred bucks.
That was a combination hearse and ambulance, so it had a siren. It was really cool. And the first time Huey and Tommy went to pick it up and bought it, of course, and then went to my dad's house, where I was living, of course, and down in Bayport. My dad had the bar and the bowling alley in Bayport. And the hearse wasn't in the front yard for more than 2 minutes before the phone started ringing up at the bar wanting to know who died at Nelson's house. So that was my dad's introduction to the mortician's hearse. It was fun.
So the siren worked?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it worked. We tried not to blow that off too often and if there were any police around. But it had the siren, and it had a hookup in the back where they had you could put oxygen tanks and that kind of thing, and then the regular rollers. So the part of traveling in the hearse, it was great to store the equipment, but it wasn't, you know, they weren't designed to be too comfortable in the back end that was used for other things. So two of us normally would have to sit on the floor in the back with all the equipment behind us.
Did you have the band name painted on the hearse?
Yeah, we had a cardboard sign that just fit in the back window with the morticians on. That was on the first one, but the second and the third one, they were painted right on the side of the car in pretty big letters, so it was pretty obvious.
Probably that 10, 12 inch letters from Bill Powell was a sign painter in Stillwater, and we'd bring them over to Bill and he'd paint them up. And his son eventually became my doctor, who has since retired, but old Stillwater family, the Powell family.
Now, what I've heard from talking with other band members who also used a hearse for their band vehicle, a hearse can be expensive as far as gas and maintenance. Is that correct?
Gas would have been the least of our problems, but, you know, these cars were used to driving very slow and idling a lot. And then you get a bunch of kids in them and load them up with a couple thousand pounds worth of equipment and go down the road 60, 70 miles an hour, and that's probably not the best thing for the life. Most of them had fairly good-sized V8s in them, you know, substantial transmission because they're pretty heavy. The reliability, although I don't think we ever missed a job, we were always there. They were expensive. When the repairs came, they were not cheap.
And they were heavy. So if we had a lot of trouble with tires at first. We'd have tread separation, like you see out on the freeway now. You see the semi-trucks have got the rubber laying all over the place. And we finally started buying tires from, I think it was Johnson Ambulance Service.
Well,
they were used ambulance tires, and they were 8-ply, so we could get some miles out of.
It was after that tornado that ripped through the Twin Cities. I think that was in 1965.
Fridley.
And it was Olson Ambulance, and they had one set of Michelin tires. And otherwise, they'd always run on bias ply tires. But the Michelin tire was a high profile, and the sides kind of squished out, whereas the bias plies were big, blocky tires. And the drivers didn't like these Michelin tires because they looked like a bicycle tire or whatever. But they were the only tires or the only set of tires that made it through all of the ambulance runs that they did in that Fridley area. And you can imagine all the broken glass and everything else that survived. But as soon as they were done with that, the drivers decided that they were going to get rid of these funny-looking Michelins. We bought them cheap, and of course Michelin was not a household name then by any stretch of the imagination as a radial tire, and we drove them, I don't know how many miles, 60,000 miles, 80,000 miles, whatever. We just drove and drove and drove on those tires.
And we also could change U-joints because the hearses had the drive shaft was two-part piece, because they were so much longer. And we could change U-joints in about a half an hour if we lost a U-joint on the road. But we had to have two jacks to pick the thing up to get underneath it because it was so heavy.
So the fact that you're driving hearses around to your gigs and your name Morticians, meaning more happiness, I would have to think this might have led to some confusion. Did your name ever get misspelled on the billing as Morticians?
Oh, of yeah. Course.
Well,
of course.
You'd see it like that. There was some place that we all had to belong to the union. So we belonged to Stillwater, or the St. Paul Musicians Union. And for a while, the contracts would always read one of the band members and then the band name. So we've got a number of posters that say Hugh Kramer and the Morticians, because that had to be listed by the Musicians Union. So he always thought that's the way it should stay, was Hugh Kramer and the Morticians.
I don't have a problem with that. But see, that's a throwback to before the Beatles, because there were the headliner and then the supporting act.
Right.
And that's, of course, we didn't want it that way, but that wasn't my call to have it on these posters. But from the contract, from the musicians' union, these bandmates or these ballrooms or whatever were just used to, you know, Wally Pickle and blah, 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 or whatever, and they just, you know, absentmindedly continued
to for some reason, though, those are the only posters that he kept were the ones that said Hugh Kramer and the Morticians.
I kept them all.
So in 1965, is the band playing more or less or the same as 1964?
During the summer, we could play, and you can see on some of those calendars that we would play up to four, maybe five nights a week during the summer, but it seemed like every weekend was filled, every Friday and Saturday night. And from a point of trying to get a band accomplished or professional or tight or moving in the right direction or whatever, there is nothing that, in my mind anyway, nothing is better than having Pete of those engagements. So if you played every Friday and Saturday night, whether you wanted to or not, you would just get better. You'd get tighter. You would, you know, start to reach out and try stuff that were a little bit different, a little more complicated, and just that repetition would really help develop the show, the act, the night.
Now, did the band develop a fan base where you had kids following you around from gig to gig?
Doc Lee was real big on the fan club and had a fan club started and even had a bunch of little tombstones made. And I think I still have one. Scott probably has one, or Chris has one. At this last gig that we had in Stillwater at the Eagles, our road manager that we had talked about, Jim Jesse, came, and around his neck was this little tombstone, this little wooden tombstone with MT on it. So he had kept it all these years, too.
There were two little gals in Minneapolis, one's name was Sue, and the other one was Jill, I think. They were the head of our fan club, and I don't know what Doc Lee ever set up with them, but Doc would come up with these figures of thousands of members of this fan club. And Doc, I think poor Doc went to his grave a little disappointed that we did not become the Beatles, that he had that vision somewhere. That I remember going down to Chicago, and we went into the building where the William Morris Agency was, and we went right up, you know, to the 13th or 15th floor, whatever it was, and he wanted to talk to William Morris because he had his band, he had his boys with him, and we've got a picture of somewhere with L.D. Young and Red Holt, the drummer and the bass player from the Ramsey Lewis Trio. And that was the year that Ramsey Lewis had an instrumental hit on the top 10, I think.
The In Crowd.
Yeah, The In Crowd with Ramsey Lewis. And they were there because William Morris booked Ramsey Lewis, and they didn't really want to jump right on to booking the Morticians right away. We tried.
Did you ever play a Battle of the Bands?
We had lots of Battle of the Bands, especially with Doc, because at the end of it, I know there's one that we did at Aldrich Arena with the Underbeats.
There's a poster right behind you with that.
And we always thought the Underbeats were just the creme de la creme. But Doc would schedule it so they'd play first, and we'd play towards the end, and then he'd get up and he'd have the crowd clap as to the band that they thought won the Battle of the Bands. And we would always win because Doc would kind of try to figure out the decibel level, and he'd say, "Yep, and the Morticians win again." And I don't know that Keith Zeller or Jimmy Johnson ever appreciated those battles of the band, but
well, we have the poster. Why don't we read off the other bands on this?
Well, we got the Foot Stompin' Underbeats, and that's Jimmy and the original band. That's long before Rico or Jimmy Walsh or anybody. And Keith Zeller. Keith was one of the original bands, one of my first bands that I saw too, Keith Zeller and the Starliners. and then us, and then the high-rising Tremadons, and we don't know what happened to the Tremadons or the ever-popular Stingrays. We're not sure where they went either. But that was at Aldrich Arena on July 14th of probably 1965, I would think.
And so Doc is the one that put the impeccable morticians, because just like the high-rising and the foot stomping and the popular, it seemed like every band had to have some kind of a descriptive adjective to, as if the name wasn't enough, they had to fill up the poster with an adjective that would describe who it was.
Now, was Doc going to all of your concerts?
No, as we you know, went out in different areas. He was a chiropractor in Stillwater, so, and our travel schedule, you know, went out quite a ways across Minnesota and Wisconsin. So, no, he wouldn't. I mean, initially he went with us because he had the driver's license and we didn't. But
and he had part of the, he must have had part of the gate too, at some of these places. Because I remember him introducing us at the, like the Elks Club in Hudson. Doc Lee would be up on the stage, and he did. He tried doing the Bill Deal thing for a while, giving away old bad record albums. And I never saw Bill Deal give away a popular record album, but Doc would do that every once in a while too.
Do you recall Doc Lee's last name?
That was his last name. Was Lee.
Oh, Lee.
James Lee. And he was a chiropractor. My dad was a housing contractor, and he would lay blocks and get a sore back. And we would go to Doc Lee up in Stillwater. And I could have a cold, and Doc Lee would treat me with chiropractic.
That his vocation was chiropractor, but his advocation was music. That's how he was. Interested and was pretty adept at the banjo, and I think he also played piano and other things, and I think that was his introduction to the music store in Hudson. He lived just across the St. Croix River from Hudson, and a storefront may have opened up, and he may have a partner, I don't know, but he was very interested in music and later became interested in us.
So what happens to the band during 1966?
Well, in late 66, Tom and I had transferred up to the U of M, mainly to make it more convenient. Pinky and Tommy and I lived together, found an apartment that Bob Dylan had rented from this same man in Minneapolis, and Tom and I transferred to the U of M, and we needed a fourth person to live there, and somehow Tommy met Dick Schreier. So Dick and I actually shared a bedroom for a couple years over in Minneapolis. And Tommy kind of lost interest in school. He wasn't that impressed with college anymore and didn't know what he was going to do, and ended up joining the Army. And he became a helicopter pilot and spent 13 months in Vietnam. Had a very distinguished career in the Army that he was very, very proud of. And then when he left, we had talked to Dick. Dick and I being roommates, Dick decided to come along with the Morticians because we could guarantee him $50 a week.
The band that he was in, the Marauders, was a big band. They were commanding good money, a very good band, but a very big band, and that requires a big vehicle, and in their case it was a bus. It was an old bus, and when they break down, it's big bills, and they would miss some gigs, and it seemed like a lot of the money that they were working hard to develop just would get channeled into this bus or whatever other transportation they could possibly muster. And Dick, being a University of Minnesota student, he needed money. So rather than our musical prowess, we could probably offer him financial security. And of course, Chris was living with him, and I think he got along with Roy and myself, and so it was a match made in heaven.